Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators where we, the teacher, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today it is my pleasure to bring you Marguerite Thompson-Aline from New York. She is a wonderful educator who has recently been popularized by this wonderful door creation that she did. We're going to talk all about that, plus about diversity and curriculum and education and everything else we decide to hit on today. Alrighty, Marguerite, how are we doing today?
Hello, Jacob. I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing amazing. Up here at the school, on wonderful, Saturday, right?
So the day. Yeah, Saturday. The work never stops.
It really does. And you know, it's funny, I have teachers across the hall. They're creating, they're building this circus themed thing in their room right now. So they're all decorating like crazy in there. So we teachers everywhere working. For anyone who's listening who's not an educator, we never stop.
Never stop. Round the clock job.
That's right. Anyway, so you, the reason I had you on today is because, I caught wind of this wonderful creation that you made. But before we jump into that and all this wonderful fame that you're getting from this, I want you to go ahead and tell us a little bit about you, where you are, what you teach, and all that good stuff for the audience.
Okay, my name is Marguerite Thompson-Aline. As you said, I am an educator in Brooklyn, New York. I teach in District 18 at My 11 School for the Performing Arts, which is also IS 285. My principal is George Patterson, and our superintendent is Ms. Beverly Wilkins. Yeah, I teach in a special education setting. This year, I teach self-contained, which is a smaller setting with students who have, various disabilities. Well, yeah, but it changes every year. One year, I might be in a self-contained or an ICT. I may teach English or math, wherever they want me to go. But this year, I teach English to 6th, 7th, and 8th grade.
See, I'm 6th grade ELA, so we're at least somewhere in the same world a little bit. What got you into special education?
After I graduated from college, I went to Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia, and I was a psychology major. But my family, I've come from a long line of educators. My mother's a teacher, father, a teacher, grandmother, a teacher, grandfather, a teacher, great-grandmother, a teacher, great-grandfather, a teacher. So it was always, I guess, in the blood. And at first, I was in school psychology, but I felt that I would be better suited to be in the classroom with the students every day. So I made the switch and haven't turned back yet.
So how long have you been doing it?
4 years.
Nice.
4 years, yeah.
4 years, that magic number. You know, we've talked about on the podcast where statistically, 3rd, 4th and 5th year of the time where teachers start dropping away. So that's when like you're either in it or not.
Absolutely. That's when this is for me. You know, you finally get into that groove and finally feel like you know what you're doing.
Yeah, and it really does. Yeah, no, it does take that long. There's no joking. Like, some people come in and they're like super rock stars right off the bat, but most of us normal people, like, it takes a little bit to,
to get adjusted.
Yeah, and I can say this is my 4th year here too, and it's I'm so comfortable in my room and what I'm doing and confident, and it makes the world's difference when you have that experience.
Absolutely. That first year, it was definitely a learning curve, but every year you add to the toolbox. Every year you get better.
Can't be said enough. Now, okay, so let's switch gears. I want to jump straight into this project that you did, and I keep calling it the project, right? it's funny is because it's simple in a lot of ways, but here's the mark of when you got me, right? I love spectacle. Like, this is, that's my thing. Like, when I did my first classroom transformation in my room, I was like, okay, I want to do something that's super obnoxiously visual. You know what I mean? Like, I want that visual punch.
Right.
And that's what yours is. It's big, it's loud, it makes a statement without going outright and making a statement. Mm-hmm. So real quick, go ahead. Let's explain to everyone what this project is. I'm going to let you do the honors of doing that for us.
Okay. So every year at my school, we have door decorating competitions. And it's usually around the holidays, like a Christmas door, Kwanzaa door, something like that. But every year I win the competition, so that's kind of become my thing. But
so you had a title you were trying to keep up with.
So that's my thing, decorating my door. But we never have done anything as far as a competition for Black History Month or Women's History Month. It's usually around the holidays. And I actually noticed the spirit the doors bring into the school community, you know. The students really enjoy coming into the school when they see the doors decorated. It really boosts morale. So since we've been studying various Black history figures in the month of Black History, myself and my educational team decided we would do something big. So we got the inspiration from a picture we saw on the internet, and we just took that picture and ran with it. So we named the door Adebayo, which is a picture of a Black girl with a huge afro that just covers the entire door and the surrounding walls. And Adebayo means the crown meets joy in Yoruba. And it really is a celebration of our beauty and our differences and our culture and of our Blackness. You know, we want to challenge those societal standards that usually don't represent us or don't give our students, you know, that boost to say that we too are beautiful. So that was the inspiration behind Adebayo, and it took off. I didn't expect it. I really didn't expect to get that much recognition for it.
Yeah, well, you know what's funny is it's the simple ideas that usually end up taking off for some reason. But I think, you know, a couple of things that you hit on right there are the things that, like, right now, specifically in what's, you know, what's happening in America, all across, you know, all across all the states, and it's happening in foreign countries too. But there we have this, it's almost like a repositioning of the social standards. People are starting to stand up and they're saying, hey, you know, we have a voice in this predominantly, like, you know, bias, like, medium in a lot of ways, you know, and there's from all these sides, and you step out and people similar doing things like you, and you're like, no, we need to represent our voices. You know, we need to show like we have the power to do this. And it's funny because you do it in like this, like the way you did the fro, right? The hair, you did the it was like paper, right? Like just little curved paper.
Yeah, it was construction paper.
But it's hilarious because it's a huge thing, and it's like, man, that is, I can't think of a better statement for this, because it's like, we're not hiding, this is what it is.
Afros are bold. Our hair is very bold, it's noticeable, you know, if we wear our hair natural, there's no missing it, you know, so I felt that we were going to go big or go home, right? So it really does make a statement, and it shifts the narrative, you know, on the standard of beauty, you know, that our natural hair also can be celebrated. So that was the purpose.
That's why this whole natural hair thing and embracing, like, you know, we, like, this is our natural look, right? And this is beautiful, and this should be celebrated. That is, I think that's kind of where some of this power is coming from, because there is this bias towards, like, oh, well, you know, you got to straighten it and stuff like that, right? I mean, do you see that?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look historically behind where straightening hair comes from, it was a tool to separate people within society and within the Black community, because if your hair was straighter, it had a looser curl, you had certain privileges that other people didn't have. And the standard of beauty was set to have loose, straight, flowing hair. So naturally, that's not what, you know, grows from our scalp. So in order to achieve that, we have to alter our hair in different ways. And, you know, I, even myself, like, to go on a job interview or to try to, you know, be a part of a certain opportunity, it's often said to me that I need to straighten my hair, because you want to detach yourself from the culture in order to assimilate. So, you know, you want to fight against that, to say, you know, no one else has to alter their hair to go to a job interview. You know, why do I? why do I need to alter who I am in order to fit in with societal standards? And, you know, those things, like you said, are subconscious biases. You know, I too, even people within my own community, if my hair is straightened, they will say, oh, you look really nice. You look very pretty. But, you know, they won't even mention anything, you know, if the afro is there. So, yeah, we want to go back, shift back to say, you know, there's nothing wrong with who you naturally are, you know, and just celebrate who we naturally are.
From your perspective, like, when it comes to teaching and education, how do your students react when you kind of bring up these topics or address this embracing of naturalness? Do they kind of light up with it? Or are they uncomfortable with, like, you know, is this okay to be talking about this? Like, how does that happen in the classroom for you?
It definitely empowers them, because if we don't teach it, then they're left to just figure it out in the world that surrounds us. So if we leave it up to the media or advertisement or what they see on TV, you know, they will just believe, they will go through the world and believe that they need to alter who they are in order to fit in. So when that idea is introduced to them, that who they naturally are is beautiful, they definitely eat that up. They definitely get into that. And Adebayo helps to, you know, support and secure that, because they walk through the door like, wow, that's powerful. And then when they look in the mirror and they say, wow, I look like her. I too am powerful, you know. So it just supports what we're trying to teach. And the students really, really, really are eating that up, you know.
You know, it's super challenging. I think history, English has some leeway, because we have some really great examples of some strong culture icons that we can point to highlight the Black community within literature. Right. I mean, there's so many things that we can draw on. So it's almost, I wouldn't say it's easier for us, but it's more popular in English. But like when it comes to history, when you're trying to get kids excited about American history or something like that, a lot of schools and teachers struggle because, you know, the history as it's taught genuinely leans way towards the white male perspective, right?
Absolutely.
Those are the people we highlight. And there are teachers out there who go out of their way to highlight, you know, there are other people of other races that did things for America. You know, it wasn't like this only white male created this thing. So, like, how do you go about bringing in these different icons to give our students something to connect to other than people that don't look like them?
Well, my mother always told me history is always written by the victor. Right. So we never hear the perspective of anyone who wasn't victorious. But English is, like you said, it's very easy to make those connections, those parallels between history and English, because let's say we're talking about the Harlem Renaissance. There's so many important people in the Harlem Renaissance who contributed to literature. We have Langston Hughes, Dora Neale Hurston, Baldwin. So we can pull in there, you know, we always talk about the classics. Those are the classics as well. So if we bring in those writers into the curriculum, then they will see, wow, you know, maybe I can be a writer as well. Or even if you go back when you're talking about, let's say, the Industrial Revolution, there, you know, we always hear about Thomas Edison and the light bulb, but we never hear about Latimer, who first introduced the filament that kept the light bulb alive, and that was a Black man, or Booker T. Washington. You know, there's so many other Blacks other than Dr. Martin Luther King, which is who everyone knows about,
right,
who, you know, influenced history and literature and art throughout, you know, different generations and different eras. So it's all about just, you know, you yourself being the historian and doing the research and figuring it out how to make it culturally relevant for the population you're teaching. So culture comes in different ways. It's not always just skin color. It could be if you're from the city or you're from the country. But especially in New York City, where the Harlem Renaissance took place, you know, it's easy to make that connection for us. So that's how I do it.
How important to you is it to get, like what change happens to our students when we give them someone that they can actually connect to? Like, I guess another way to phrase that is, like, if we spend all of our time, you know, only showing them, you know, only showing that, you know, white people write books or white people, mm-hmm. you know, do political movements or stuff like mm-hmm. that, or, you know, insert whatever bias you want. How important is it to give our students people that they can look up to that are like them in more ways than right. just, you know, what they're into or something like that? How important is that to the curriculum in terms of empowering our students?
Well, most importantly, that's important because it offsets the current narrative of who we are. You know, we are told who we are, and when we look at what the curriculum is saying, it's not always positive. You know, when we look at the curriculum, our history or who we are usually starts with slavery, but it doesn't say who we are throughout the African diaspora and who we were throughout the African diaspora before slavery. It doesn't speak about, you know, the levels to blackness and culture in Africa and how that transcends throughout the Caribbean and the United States. So when we put this information into the curriculum, it offsets that narrative that you can only be successful if, let's say, just one bias, if you are a basketball player or an entertainer. When we see that you too can be an artist, you too can be a scientist, you too can be an astronomer, you too can be in music or so forth, it gives students that tangible evidence that they too are great and they can achieve. Like, I was fortunate to go to Historically Black College, so that greatness was always around me. I saw Black professors, I saw Black scientists and Black doctors. And, you know, and I was fortunate to grow up in a household with educated Black people, but not everyone is brought up in that way. So the charge is on me as the educator to serve the population that I teach. So yes, of course, we're going to highlight American history in its entirety. And American history in its entirety is Black history as well, because Blacks and minorities and immigrants have so much to do with development of this nation. So if we include everyone, you know, everyone can be great.
You know, I got chills right then, just because, no, I mean, you're speaking the truth, and this is something that I think a lot of people, like, they might be afraid to talk about it, but I think it just gets overlooked sometimes because, mm-hmm. you know, we do talk about, like, some people like, oh, well, you're changing curriculum, you can't erase history. It's like, no, we're trying to tell the whole story, right? Mm-hmm. It's like
they're the whole story, not half of the story, you know?
Yeah, and I think that is one, I mean, it's so powerful to our students to show them. Like, for instance, we were doing, we did a project here, a school-wide project, and we were highlighting leaders it was like a leadership thing, and we had different leaders from certain eras. And our era was like from the 60s. And a Black kid that was in my class, he goes, "Where are all the Black people at?" And I was like, that's a really good point. I was like, you know, and, you know, I didn't make the list. Another teacher had made the list, and they didn't go through it. But it was probably some, you know, it probably wasn't an intentional left out. You know what I mean? It was just an overlooking, like the same thing that happens when we teach history. It's things have been done a certain way for so long. Mm-hmm. We've only taught the certain books so long that all of this gets overlooked. And I looked at him and I was like, you know what? We're going to sit down and we're going to find those people because that's, that's a fantastic point, right? Where are the Black people? Where are the other races a part of the conversation?
Yeah, that student, that particular student was looking at it like he didn't have a connection to those leaders. Connection is everything. You know, why are certain people great? Because they had someone who laid the foundation for them. And naturally, as we all know, psychology teaches us that people gravitate to people who are like them. You know, that's just our innate, you know, I guess, what do I say, selfish nature, that we want to get, or we gravitate to people who are like us. So if you want someone to be great, show them someone who is like them. And it would reinforce the fact that they too can be great.
I find that when I've tried to have these conversations in certain groups or with certain people, they're always like, why does it come down to race? So, like, what's your response to someone who responds to that when we're talking about this conversation?
Race in this country is the main tool that was used to separate people. You know, you didn't separate people based on their character. You didn't take time to figure out who they were or what their talents were. In order to maintain power, race was the number one tool. So if you were within this racial group, you were amongst this group of people. Or if you were in this racial group, you were amongst another group of people. And that's the way we stratified our society. So when it comes down to highlighting people, it's always, you cannot avoid the conversation of race, because that is the history of our country. So if you're talking about someone in power, it would be remiss for you to omit someone of another race. And if you just look at the people who are in power, that is why the election of Barack Obama was so great. Because was there ever another before him? And why do you think that was? It was because throughout our country, you know, blacks and other minorities were not seen to be what? Worthy of those positions. So you cannot, you know, it is an uncomfortable conversation to have, but you cannot hide from the truth. You know,
yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
And, you know, it's like this last election, one of the things that, like, the, you know, there was, I mean, so much negativity on the election, obviously, but there was also, like, I remember sitting there and just looking at, like, the panel of people, really on both sides for the most part, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Where is the representation of our diversity in this country up here? Like, you know, yeah. It's to the point to where it's so glaringly obvious that we are so, you know, politically and where the power lies in America is so one-sided in most degrees that it's like, when are we gonna like fix this? You know what I mean? Like, how long does it take? And Obama was a huge step in that direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but then we kind of, you know, we took a different step afterwards. Yeah. And then it was like
the total opposite.
Opposite. I think we see that in education too, though. In like areas all around the world. Like, for instance, like at our school. I did a project from one of my master's classes where I looked at the teacher population to the student population. And we are way on the white side compared to what our student population is. So from teacher to student. And for me, I mean, you can't just fire all the teachers and hire new teachers, right?
No.
But it's still something that we have to like be super conscious of, because there's anxieties that come with racial differences. There's biases that sneak into curriculum and how you teach.
Right, absolutely.
And like, from your perspective, like how do we, like, when you're looking at what to teach and stuff, where do you decide to bring in those other culture pieces? Is it just always, or do you have like a way to look at your lesson plans and go, okay, how am I going to bring this to them? Like, what's your thinking strategy when it comes to bringing this stuff into your lessons?
Well, you know, just to touch on that first comment that you said about when you look at the ratio of who is teaching to the student population, you know, historically, education is a white female profession. And so many people like have messaged me after, you know, making the story to say, you know, I've never had a black teacher. I never had a black male teacher, and so on. And the narrative and the conversation has evolved just from this project. And that is true. A lot of people have never had a black teacher. They usually have a Caucasian teacher, and that those biases that people just naturally carry with them, you know, you almost do a disservice to yourself and to your teaching pedagogy if you don't educate yourself about the population that you're teaching. So yes, we have to stick to the curriculum, but you always have to be mindful of what the audience is. And that's with anything. Let's say you're DJing at a party. You want to make sure you play the music of the people who are at the party. Or if you're having a speaking arrangement, I mean, if it's from primarily older people, you're going to change your vernacular and you're going to change the way you speak and, you know, what you talk about. So the same thing goes for teaching. So with my students and in special education specifically, what we realize within the country that it is dominated by minority males. And we cannot overlook that special education is dominated by minority males. Is it that minority males are not capable of learning? No. those biases early on in their education kind of funneled them into special education because people did not understand the way in which they learned. So if you have a person who is used to being in a classroom where students sit quietly and are very quiet and mute and listen and, you know, do this and do that, then, but you have a student who's used to learning with movement and verbs and music and interaction, you will look at this student and say, something is wrong with him. He doesn't understand how to be quiet or how to sit still. He must have ADHD or he must have this or that. So they get funneled into special education and other things like that because people do not understand who they are. And with that in mind, when I walk into the classroom and one of my classes is an entirely male class, all African-American boys, not one girl, I cannot get up there and talk about, try to teach them something, how do I say it? Trying to be politically correct. You know, I cannot walk into the classroom and teach them something that they are not connected to. So with that in mind, let's say that we have, in preparation, let's say I know that there's a story that I need to teach. I may change the setting. I might change the name, the place that the story takes place. I may change the name of the characters to names that they're comfortable with hearing in their community. So I might change Jack to Jaden, or I might change Jim to Shamar, so that they're like, oh, Shamar, oh, that's my brother. Oh, Jaden, oh, that's my cousin. Or, you know, Brownsville, I live there. As opposed to saying, oh, from the Upper East Side. You know, you're not from the Upper East Side. You're from Harlem. You know, you're not from Park Slope. You're from Brownsville. You know, just make it more culturally relevant to what's going on. And therefore, they have a connection to the text. So it's easier for me to teach literacy because they're already invested in the text. They hear names that are familiar with them, you know, and so on and so forth. So there's different ways to cater to the students that you teach.
Yeah, and you know what? As a, like, I look at my library and I pride myself on the amount of books I have in my library, mm-hmm. but still I have to make a conscious effort to look at them and go, okay, what, you know, who am I serving here? Is it fill in my bookshelves? You know, I can have a million books, but if it's nothing but a bunch of white boys, mm-hmm. you know, in the books, then, you know, I'm missing massive demographics. You know, the same thing, you know, for females, right? They need those strong female leads. But this thing mm-hmm. goes for race. It goes for sex. It goes for all of these things. We need to constantly be reaching out to our students to connect them to what we want them to learn. Otherwise, I mean, why would they care?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm so happy. Like, at my school, we have, every year we have what's called the Juneteenth Project. So most people don't know about Juneteenth, which was a historical event in our history in which the Emancipation Proclamation was read to the slaves in Texas, right? And it was on June 19th. And as we know, after the Emancipation Proclamation was written, it took a long time for it to actually reach certain places in our country. So there were a lot of people who were freed, but they didn't know. The information wasn't given to them, so they were continuing to work and live as usual. So there was a day, June 19th, in Texas, in which the slaves were freed, and it was a huge celebration. So what we do every year, we have a huge celebration, and in that, students are able to delve into different aspects of their culture, either through literature, through music, through art, different aspects of who we are, and that really also adds to, you know, building up that information of self, because we lack information of self, and when you get information of self, you're empowered. So we want to make sure we always have those type of events in which we can enrich our curriculum, you know, to serve the community that we, you know, that we work in.
I absolutely amazing. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so glad that we were able to have Miss Marguerite on the podcast. Can't say enough good things about her. There were some great moments in that episode, and there are great moments to come in episode 2. I cannot stress that enough. Shout out to everyone at her campus. They sound like they are doing some amazing things over there. And I can't wait for you guys to hear part 2 next week on Monday, as usual. By the way, if you're a night owl on Sundays, it's usually what I'm posting about Sunday night around 10 p.m., 11 p.m., depending on what's going on that Sunday. So you can always catch a little early if that's you. Just a hint from me to you. Now, with that said, I have a huge announcement, ladies and gentlemen. Teach Me Teacher has been going for a year and a half. Completely self-funded on a teacher's salary. That would be me. No one helped me start it. No one created the website. No one did any of that. No one bought the equipment. No one set up the interviews. It is all me. It is a one-man show up until today. What I want to do is I've been thinking about how to grow the show in a lot of ways. And as the show gets bigger and bigger, it's becoming more apparent that I can't do it alone. I need somebody's help. And with that said, there's a couple ways people do that. A lot of podcasts, if you're a podcast listener, people get ads to come on their podcast, and they fill it up with sponsorships and all that other stuff. And, you know, this isn't a terrible way to go, but it does add that corporate entity in there, which isn't always their goals aren't always in line with what creators want. And I don't really want Teach Me Teacher to go down the route of serving corporate interest or serving those types of interests that are only in there to make money off of us. What I am trying to do with every episode is to bring you guys the best information and education possible by reaching out to big names and small names all across the United States. And I feel like if I do the sponsorship route, if I do those ad reads, I think it'll diminish the quality of the show in a couple ways. So the other way that people can grow their podcast and grow the community is to ask the community to support. You know, I've never asked anything from you guys other than a review and a share. But this time I'm actually reaching out to you guys. Officially, as you hear this podcast, Teach Me Teacher is going on Patreon. We are launching our first Patreon. And if you don't know what Patreon is, it is a way for you to support the show anywhere from $1 a month to more, depending on what fits your budget, you know, what you would like to support the show. Now, you get rewards for supporting the show, and there's goals set for the show to get as many to grow and to do amazing things. But really, all of that aside, this is my way of letting you guys be more a part of the show. I want you guys to have more of a say in what's going on. I want you to feel invested in what's going on, and I want you to help me grow it. I don't want to grow Teach Me Teacher with the wants and needs of corporations just trying to get ad reads out of me. I don't want to only serve people who are trying to advertise their product. I want to get teachers to be the best they can be, and I feel like the best way to do that is to ask you guys to join me in this and to support the show and to help me keep growing it, because it is a one-man show, but I would love to be a community show. I want us all to be involved. I want you guys to take ownership of the episodes and of the podcast and help me create something amazing for you guys. So I've put together a Patreon. If you go over to Patreon, that is patreon.com/teachmeteacher. That's patreon.com/teachmeteacher. You will go over there and see the brand new Patreon. It has everything. Over on the right side, you're going to see that if you donate $1, that's going to give you access to behind the scenes of the show. It's going to be absolutely amazing. I'm going to have all this content for you guys where you can see me in the process of creating. You get sneak peeks at shows coming up. That's the freshman level. If you go up to the sophomore level, that's $5. And, you know, this might not seem like a lot of money to support the show with, but I feel like it's a huge amount. So to give back to you is I'm actually giving you guys exclusive early access to my upcoming book that is coming out. You're going to see early chapters. You're going to be involved in it before anyone else sees it. And you'll have a chance to get a copy before anyone gets their hands on it, as well as behind the scenes and everything else. Now, I'm not going to sit here and read off all of the tiers. I want you to go to Patreon. To see all the amazing things that I've planned for you guys. Now, with that said, if you go over there and you think of another idea for me to do, feel free to shoot me an email. The Patreon is for you guys. And for your support, I'm trying to give back 10 times what you guys give me, right? This isn't me trying to do something to scam you guys into money. Hopefully, I've proven that I'm not a scammy type of person by doing a podcast for a year and a half without asking for one single thing. You know, that was intentional, and I wanted to show you guys that I'm in this for the right reasons. I'm in this for education. I believe in education. I believe in you. I believe in teachers. So if you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/teachmeteacher. Drop us your support over there. I would love to see you over there. Thank you in advance for all that you do. Thank you for your support, whether you go to Patreon or you like it on iTunes or like us on Facebook, whatever your form of support is. I completely appreciate it. We're all educators. We're all just trying to make it. I hope you guys help me make this thing bigger. But until next time, ladies and gentlemen, next week, have a good one.